This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And who we are is often shaped by where we are from. And I want to introduce you today to a short story writer, a novelist, a professor emeritus of American Indian Studies, Dr. Linda Lagarde Grover. Her latest book is Gitche-Gami Hearts, Stories and Histories from Mesabi-Kong. Linda, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, good morning. It's nice to be here. Thank you.
So I want to start with this idea of places and the naming of a place, because you talk in the book how this place in Minnesota that most of us call Duluth is, like is often the case, named after somebody, not after the thing that it is. Onig-Gamazing. Did I get that right?
That's very close. It's okay. Onig-Gamazing.
Onig-Gamazing. That is the traditional word of your people for Duluth. What does that word mean?
It's for the region, and that's something I just noticed as I was working on Gitche-Gami Hearts. It occurred to me that you see many, many places that have been named after people, towns, you know, but here in Duluth, it's true, it is named after Daniel Gracelyn Sear Duluth, who was here a long time ago as involved in the exploration and the fur trade. But the place here, one of the words for this place is Onig-Gamazing, which means the place of the small portage. Mm-hmm. And that refers probably to, you know, we're right on Lake Superior, and there's a 5 mile long peninsula off of Duluth, and there is and people who were traveling on water long ago had to portage over land. And so that peninsula at a couple places is only like 2 blocks wide. Mm. And so it was a very easy, short portage. So it's kind of like the living and the work are easy here. So that's one of the words for the place here. And the other is in the title of Gitche-Gami Hearts, Stories and Histories from Mesabi-Kong. Mesabi-Kong is another word for this place, and it translates in English to the place of the giants. And we live on the shores of a lake, and there's a lot of big hills and rocks and rock outcroppings around here. And there is also a large ridge of rock that runs for a long ways, like a couple hundred miles or more from along the shore of Lake Superior. Mm. And so the idea of the place of the giants. In old stories, there are there's more reference to this that I guess have to do with our hero in Ojibwe country up here, Nanabuju.
The place of the small portage, the place of the giants, they both give this flavor of you get a sense of what that place is really like. And you used this phrase, the living and the work here are easy. And I wonder how much of that do you think it can be said factors into what is often referred to, at least in your books, as this Ojibwe way of life, of making a good life?
Bimadaziwin, Mino Bimadaziwin is the living of a good life, and that is that's kind of like a path that Ojibwe Anishinaabe people endeavor to walk their whole lives. And so you both never arrive at the destination and are already at that destination of living of a good life. And yeah, it's not like the work and life are easy. I think that's what's notable about the place of the small portage, is that it's a much easier portage than you'd find other places.
It's a relative term.
But, yeah, relative. But the idea that one would want to live the good way, that that was demonstrated by generations before us and by our own parents and grandparents. And it's something we try to pass on to our younger people too. So it's a continuing way of life and a keeping in mind that living of the good ways of the, you know, keeping the Anishinaabe values and all that is important to us as Ojibwe people.
And what are some of what you would call the hallmarks of living the good way?
There is an awareness that we have been created and everything has been created for us by Gije Manidu, the Great Spirit. And so with that is an acknowledgement of, so it's the living of a life that really has a spiritual foundation and thread all the way through it. So it's being thankful, being humble, knowing that we have not really done this by ourselves, and being aware that that because everything's a gift, that we must be respectful and take good care of it, and also be aware that others were created also. We've been given much. We are rich, and so, of course, we would like to be generous people, generous materially, but also having a generosity of spirit, of attitude.
Why did you want to weave stories in this book that are both things that are true in the understanding of the word that, you know, it's provable, it's demonstrable, it happened in your lifetime, and then these rich oral traditions that have been passed on for generations, most often in the time of the year of storytelling, the winter. But this blending of those two types of storytelling, why put them together?
I think that our lives are a blending of what we've been taught and what we're living right now. And I've thought, you know, in some of the things I have written here, I can see almost a reliving and a pattern of repeating things that we were taught, things we experienced, and things that we have learned, and that this is an ongoing thing. So there is not, to me, as years have gone by, I have seen less of a separation between these things. And so I think in writing Gichigami Hearts, I think that wasn't my intention when I started writing. Actually, I don't know what the intention was, but I think that kind of has emerged on its own.
Yeah, when did you know what the intention was? Halfway through the book, when it was published, when you started talking about it?
I have stuff that I've written and just kind of, it's kind of put aside for when the time seems right for it to go, you know, in whatever direction it will. And I think that's how it was with Gichigami Hearts. I began to write about the Point of Rocks, which is a large rock formation, a big hill in Duluth here that really pretty much divides the city in half. And about what the Point of Rocks means today to people and what it would have been like long time ago to people, and where the Point of Rocks fits into some of the old stories, and where the old stories then are kind of sitting there with the Point of Rocks for us to I guess look at and maybe take in. So that was, I started writing about the Point of Rocks, and then you know, I knew that from there it would go in some direction. I had, you know, wasn't really sure where, and so it did. It, you know, so this book has, you know, it has a blend of family stories from my family, and then some of the old stories and some of the more contemporary ones. There's a little bit of poetry in there, and there's some fiction in there too. And I think it just kind of these things kind of converged here as I was working on this manuscript.
The book is called Gichigami Hearts, Stories and Histories from Misabi Kong. It is the latest book from Linda Lagarde Grover. She is an Anishinaabe novelist and a short story writer, an enrolled member of the Bois Fort Band of the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe, and a professor emeritus of American Indian Studies at the University of Minnesota Duluth, also a columnist for the Duluth News Tribune, one of those women who just kind of does it all.
Many things and one thing, I guess you could think of it as.
Once again, that theme of blending and not seeing separation. I'm wondering if you can talk about this place, Misabi Kong, Onegamezing, Gichigami, and how important they are to the Ojibwe migration. Start us off with where...
With the migration.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I did, you know, have to bring that into the story, too, because in establishing a sense of time and place, I mean, of course, where are the reference points? So the Ojibwe people, the Anishinaabe people, long time ago, hundreds of years ago, probably around a time of very, very early Northern European contact here, began a great migration from the East Coast, where they were living, from like Maine up into, you know, into Canada, Newfoundland, that part of the continent, and through a series of directions, dreams, and visions that were sent by the Creator were directed that it was time to move westward. Mm-hmm. And so over a long period of time, and not everybody, you know, just got up and moved at the same time, but over a long period of time, different groups of people then began that migration. And the route over that period of time followed roughly the route of where the Great Lakes are. And along the way, there were stopping points of great significance in history and spiritual beliefs and ways of being for the Ojibwe. And there were also points at which people stopped and stayed and established where they were going to be living. And so here at the tip of Lake Superior, on the western end of Lake Superior, is one of the places where things stopped. When they got to like Mackinac Island in Michigan, there was a splitting off of people. I mean, it was friendly, I'm sure, and some people went north and some people went in a southern direction, but kept going westward. And so here in Onegamasing, in Duluth here, this is a point where there was a fur post in far west Duluth on the St. Louis River, and that was also a community where Native people had been living then for quite some time. My own ancestors, some of them came down from Canada from the north, and others came from the southern part and came from the Madeline Island and that region there in northern Wisconsin, Michigan. And so when they were settled, the people who were settled here then, when the fur post opened, and voyagers and certainly trappers, adventurers, all kinds of people were starting to come in here. There was interaction then between the I don't know if you'd even call them settlers yet, and the Anishinaabe people who were living here, and that certainly became part of our history too. And so we, you know, the history is it's complex. It's also rich and beautiful. And so there are many parts of the history. You know, we can't always paint lovely pictures of things, but at the same time, it is, you know, what we are and really who we are as a people now.
I've read a few of your books, and that phrase that you just said, we can't always paint a lovely picture, I've often been struck by how overwhelmingly positive your books are. And In fact, when I was reading Anik Amasing, Seasons of an Ojibwe Year, I remember there being this essay about Thanksgiving and this understanding that is happening to some extent now, that the story of colonization is at times brutal and had lasting impacts on the indigenous peoples of this land. And yet that essay was very positive. It was family coming together. And I sort of remember thinking, oh, I'm really struggling with how to form this question.
Well, you know, being thankful and having a feast together is something that was done here long before European people came here.
Sure.
And so the idea at the end of the harvest, you know, especially in climates that are really harsh, the idea of a feast when you've done your very best to gather and to, you know, preserve, to store, to keep things safe, look to see that you'll be able to make it through a long winter season ahead. A feast of gratitude is something that is traditional in, I think, probably most tribal ways of being in North America.
Sure.
And so the idea of Thanksgiving, I mean, it's a national holiday. I don't know. I enjoy getting together with my family and having a nice meal.
Yeah.
We certainly don't sit around talking about, how difficult things, can be.
Mm-hmm.
We just enjoy the idea of it. And, you know, I always have. So, and I know everyone has a different, opinion and way of being about things, but I think Thanksgiving is I think we should have it more often, in my opinion, and I mean, since we are walking towards remembering to be thankful every day, I don't let some of these terrible, terrible things take away or own me, I guess, and take away things that I love and that I think are good things.
Mm.
And, you know, my dad, I remember him saying to me a couple times about when I would be trying things or going in situations, working in Indian education programs, and, these were, during my career, my work time, I mean, Indian education programs and having an Indian studies department in a university, that was something that I would have had a hard time imagining when I was a girl. And so, it was going out into something that often that you just had no idea what might be out there for you. And my dad would say, well, make it your own. And so those are words that I have kept close at hand for a very long time.
Mm.
So Thanksgiving, I make it my own.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if the point I was trying to make in that really terribly executed question is it a kind of racism that I was doing in just trying to keep Indigenous people locked into a terrible time period instead of this full expression of understanding what happened in the past, but still having remarkable, full, beautiful, happy lives?
You know, it's complicated, I guess, and that's a very simple way to put it, isn't it, to say it's complicated? but it is, and we live with this stuff. I mean, Thanksgiving is one thing. I mean, these days in, the media we see finally something that has been there for a very long time, which is that there have been missing and murdered Indigenous women and men too. And this is nothing new. What's new is the media. And so that's the media is a very powerful powerful thing, isn't it? And so now there are many people very concerned and upset, and, you know, and this is a concerning and upsetting thing that has been with us as long as I can remember. And the other thing that we see in the media, now this, you know, I think interest in this in mainstream media looks to be fading, which is, you know, sad but not unexpected, mm-hmm. is that of boarding schools for Native children. Mm-hmm. The first thing I saw, we have been aware of that for a long time. I have been writing about this for a very long time. But the first we saw really in mainstream media was in Canada with the discovery of children having died at school and
hundreds
and
of
being
graves.
Buried at school. But, you know, that certainly occurred here in the United States, too. And that is something that I think the whole country probably should find a way to come to terms with in some way. And mm-hmm. I wish I knew, you know, the answer, you know, the way to resolve this, but I don't. But I think it's a good thing that it has gotten public attention. At the same time, there's, you know, a lot of outrage on the part of people who I think might not even remember about this a year from now. And so mm-hmm. that saddens me because that is with us. And so there's things to be thankful for all the time, every single day. We are incredibly blessed by the Creator. At the same time, you know, you kind of hold a mirror up to it and look at the reflection of it. There mm-hmm. are some terribly traumatic things, not just from the past, but that happened today, that we not only owe it to the people who went before us, but it honors them to acknowledge this and to live and to thrive where we can.
Mm, that word honor, how does it do a person honor to listen to them?
I think what it means to me is that someone is listening. Now, that person may think that they are validating this by their presence and by listening, but that's not it at all, because that, to me, that's kind of a it's kind of a tipping of power things, like, oh, you know, I'm listening to you, but
right.
I'm going to be outraged for you for a week, you know.
Sure.
But I do think listening is, and, you know, it's the old time Anishinaabe way of teaching and learning. You know, you mentioned the oral tradition earlier, mm-hmm. and the oral tradition, in my observation, one part of it is the listening and hearing. You know, we think of it as like hearing the old time stories and passing them on, and that is certainly important. You know, but the other parts to it are not always seen, I don't think, outside of Indian country, which is we learn from observing also. And by eventually, when the time, you know, seems right, to maybe try experiencing things for ourselves, always learning every single day. And then when we have that a knowledge or ability to then pass it on to someone else, to a younger generation, and that's the continuity of Anishinaabe people. And so to me, it is honoring not just that person, it is honoring a, you know, an entire people.
Hmm.
And yourself.
The book is called Gitigami Hearts, Stories and Histories from Masabikang. The author, Dr. Linda Lagarde Grover, is a novelist and short story writer and a professor emeritus of American Indian Studies at the University of Minnesota, Duluth. Thank you so much for your time today, Linda.
Oh, thank you so much. I enjoyed talking with you.
The book is out today. Still to come on Main Street, North Dakota, and the drought. But first, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. House and Senate budget writers will be meeting over the next 3 weeks to essentially write the bill or bills on how to spend $1 billion in federal COVID relief money. The proposals will be taken up in a November session. Senate Appropriations Committee Chairman Ray Holmberg of Grand Forks says topping the priority list will be infrastructure.
Roads, bridges, those kinds of things which are going to be built at some point. We have an opportunity to utilize some of this federal money to do that.
Holmberg also says there are some workforce issues to be considered, including child care.
Because there are folks that are not working that could be in the workforce but aren't because they don't have child care. So they stay home. Therefore, there are fewer people working than actually could be, I believe, if we had a more robust child care system in the state. How to do that, I'm not 100% sure.
The committees will be meeting six times over the next 3 weeks to finalize proposals for the session. And as the legislature's two appropriations committees wrestle with writing the bills to spend that money, some of it will go towards spending the 2021 regular legislative session passed but did not fund. House Bill 1395 reallocated spending from the earlier coronavirus relief fund. Here's House Majority Leader Chet Pollard of Carrington.
Because there was infrastructure for DOT in there for $317 million, and so we need to allocate those dollars out. Those monies weren't available. They will be now with the ARPA funds.
Pollard says the rest of the ARPA funds will be used for one-time spending with a high priority on infrastructure. And one of the proposals for the $1 billion in American Recovery Plan Act dollars is to use $100 million for a natural gas pipeline from the Bakken to eastern North Dakota. There appears to be a lot of support among state lawmakers for it. Justin Kringstead is the director of the North Dakota Pipeline Authority.
Historically, there's always been a desire to connect the gas supplies in western North Dakota to growing demand in the eastern part of the state. The challenge has always been that distance between western North Dakota and eastern North Dakota. And so you're continuing to see bipartisan support for, you know, efforts by the legislature to use potentially some of these funds that are available to help bridge that gap, to connect the supply in western North Dakota to potential growth in the eastern part of the state.
Kringstead says new businesses in the east are looking for natural gas. He says it will potentially reduce flaring and could mean more oil production as well. The proposals include matching money from companies that want to provide the service.
Typically, a pipeline of this size from western North Dakota to eastern North Dakota, you're probably looking at a project somewhere in that $800 million to $1.2 billion type investment.
Governor Burgum has shown his support for this kind of project. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Mega drought is hammering almost half of the United States. Here in North Dakota, it's drawing comparisons to the Dust Bowl. Ranchers are selling their herds and are worried about having enough feed to feed whatever cattle they can keep. NPR's Kirk Sigler reports.
Charlie, out.
Towner, North Dakota proudly boasts it's the capital of the state's cattle country. Joey and Scott Bailey own a slice of it, a remote ranch about 60 miles south of the U.S.-Canada border.
Come on, girls.
After feeding, sitting in their kitchen, they're trying to figure out how they'll get through these next few months.
Any of your prairie hay, just your grass hay, that we would spend $30 a bale, people are spending $150 a bale, and they're driving 250 miles to get it.
The couple sold 20 cows a few months back because they couldn't afford to keep them fed. It's been so dry, they could barely make any hay.
We didn't have any rain last fall, and we had hardly any snow, and we had a super warm winter, which, yeah, we were excited about, but when we don't get snow in North Dakota, that hurts us a lot in the spring because we need the snow to make it grow right away in the spring.
So they may have to downsize even more just to stay afloat through winter. The historic drought has put a serious strain on forage, meaning hay and feed are at a premium.
So you're fighting with your neighbor, your friend, the guy down the road, you know, because there's only so much feed out there. It's extremely stressful.
Scott is in his early 40s, Joey in her late 30s. It's hard enough to get young people to stay in agriculture, even in normal times. And they worry this drought will cause even more of their neighbors to have to take on 8-to-5 jobs in town or just get out of the business altogether. You can tell Scott particularly feels this pressure. His great-grandfather first settled the family out here.
They made it, and them were a lot tougher times. Because if they wouldn't have made it, we wouldn't have had a family farm to be around, or I wouldn't be a fifth-generation rancher.
Just like in every other bad drought cycle, the Dust Bowl, 1988, ranchers here are trying to look at this crisis philosophically. A few miles east along Highway 2 on his family's farm, James Green says you just have to keep going, adapt, and survive. There have always been cycles of punishing drought.
Honestly, I'm going to plan for next spring to be like a normal spring, because if you doomsday it, you're just going to be doomsdaying the rest of your life.
Green is adapting by making hay bales out of failed crops rather than drive the 250 miles for expensive hay. He drills into a bale to get samples to test for nitrates. He wants to make sure there aren't any harmful contaminants from farm fertilizers.
You just don't want to turn your cows out here and get them sick, and you want to know what they're eating.
An endless blue sky with big, puffy white clouds above him. Green is standing in a field of mostly brown stubble.
I've never seen a June or July as hot as we had it. And it just, literally, these plants would get, 4 or 5 inches tall, and they burn off.
Look closer, though, and there are little shoots of green grass popping up. It did finally rain some, not a drought buster, but life-saving rains at least, enough to make James's 72-year-old mom, Gwen, who's standing behind him, smile in relief.
If we can get a month of grazing here, that's a godsend.
It's also been a godsend having her sons around to keep the farm going. Her husband passed away last year. She says they're doing what they've always done, getting creative, finding unconventional feed. She also got some grant money to buy new, more efficient watering systems. But this drought also feels different.
This is much worse than anything I've been through in 44 years out here. James asked me one day, what would Dad do? I said, Dad hasn't seen anything this worse either, so we just have to do what we're doing.
Keep doing what they're doing. If you get depressed, they say, you're not going to make it. Still, the long-term outlook from climate scientists isn't good. North Dakota is already a place of extremes. State climatologist Adnan Akuz says the effects of climate change may be even worse here than other states that are closer to the oceans.
I would say it is the epicenter. With the 2.4 degree Fahrenheit per century, it is one of the highest in the nation.
North Dakota is nearly 2.5 degrees warmer than it was a century ago. Akuz says just back in 2019, North Dakota had one of its wettest years on record, only to be followed by 2021's historic drought and heat waves. This September 30th, the capital, Bismarck, hit 98 degrees.
North Dakota has the geographical center of North America and makes it very prone to these climatic shifts.
Climate change doesn't seem to come up much when you talk to ranchers. But maybe when you're just trying to figure out how to last the next few months, it's hard to think about planning for a future of more extremes. Even if this does turn out to be just another bad cycle, it will take ranchers on these windswept plains years to recover.
It's North Dakota wind. Yeah, it's we have a North Dakota wind just about every day.
In a two-bar blip of a town called Granville, I meet Daryl Leese. He's the president of the North Dakota Farm Bureau. He pulled over here in between meetings with fellow ranchers. Lee says the sell-offs are crushing to see because ranchers spend decades building up quality genetics in their herds.
Just imagine if you had a job for 20 years and now you had to go to another job and your benefit package ain't as attractive. Maybe your pay scale ain't as good, because when you have to buy livestock back, you might not get the same quality that you had.
Ranchers have already sold off nearly 25% more cattle than last year. Drive around the state, and it's an ominous yet all too familiar scene. Trailers lined up outside the auction barns. It's the sound of wealth being drained from the prairie. Some barns have reported a tenfold increase in sales. Here in Devil's Lake, men clutching whips herd a drove of black Angus into a chute, opening a huge, hulking metal door.
1734.
The anxious cows, white tags clipped to their ears, are funneled into a fenced pen and sawdust floor.
Here we go. I'll go for your cows. I'm going to do here $60.
It is a short-term boon for sale barns, but no one is celebrating. In the back office, this barn's owner, Jim Ziegler, sighs as he swats flies off a desk cluttered with paper and receipts. He figures a lot of his older customers won't be back next year.
The cost is just prohibitive. We're around the coffee table over there in the cafe. The guy's talking around about hay costing $100 a bale. That isn't something you do if you have a large cow herd.
Ziegler opened this barn in 1988, the last real bad drought year. In those days, ranches tended to be smaller, he says, and people could figure a way through. Now it just costs too much to keep a big operation going. He says this crisis feels different.
People just did not get in a position where they felt comfortable going into winter. And there's going to be more and more of that. There's going to be more decisions have to be made here as we go through the next 30 days.
Make or break decisions as the prospect of another dry winter looms. Kirk Ziegler, NPR News, Devil's Lake, North Dakota.
Coming up next on Main Street, we check in with horticulturist Ron Smith about lawn and garden care.
Hello, I'm Errol Pepcorn. Do you like to know stuff? Do you really need to know that Rutland once held the record for the world's largest hamburger? That Governor Frank Briggs may haunt the old governor's mansion? That the first oil boom here started in 1950? That the first building built as a mosque in the United States was in North Dakota? Then Dakota Date Book is for you. Listen for it on the air or read it yourself at prairiepublic.org.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative. Touchstone Energy Cooperatives comprise a nationwide network of over 730 consumer-owned electric cooperative utilities dedicated to community, integrity, accountability, and innovation.
And by Next Blue of North Dakota, all-in-one Medicare Advantage plans made for North Dakotans by North Dakotans. For whatever's next, nextbluend.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg in studio with horticulturist Ron Smith to talk about fall lawn and garden care. Ron, thanks for joining us
today.
It's
a pleasure to be here,
Ashley. I hope you're having a lovely fall.
Oh, we are. I love these kind of days that we've been having. They're just fantastic, fantastic,
yeah, nice
fantastic.
And warm.
Warm days, cool nights.
The wasps I could do without.
Absolutely. My wife and I have had plenty of unfortunate experiences with wasps in our backyard. So the thing you want to watch out for is when you're collecting your leaves or picking up your grass clippings, mm-hmm. don't have them hang around because they're going to be looking for anything that's going to be moist and has any kind of aroma. And for heaven's sakes, if you're sitting out in your yard drinking soda pop or a beer, you know, out of a can, make sure you keep that can
cover on it
because a doggone wasp will go in after the doggone
thing. Yeah, I had one go in my smoothie the other day.
And I can't imagine what a sting on the tongue or the lip would feel like, but it would be pretty bad.
It is nice to be enjoying the weather while we can, but there is some work to do. What should we be doing right now?
We need to try to keep our lawns clear of leaves accumulating on them too much. You don't have to go out and chase every single leaf, but if you have trees in your neighborhood that are dropping a lot of leaves and your lawn gets covered, you see more brown leaves and you do grass, get them cleaned up because the grass needs those sun rays to go ahead and make photosynthates that get transferred into the root system and the crown and the tillers and everything else of the grass, and it'll come back a lot better next year. So keep your leaves picked up. Take them to where they can be composted, recycle them, or recycle them yourself. If you don't want to do something like that, then leave your mower on the mulch only and kind of go over it two or three times to break up the leaves into the size of cornflakes, and then they will eventually break down and help to nourish your lawn.
Am I correct in remembering that if you're going to put leaves in your compost and then put the compost down in your garden beds, you don't want to do this year's leaves, right?
No. If you can, you need a year to go ahead and break things down, yes. And
all
so
right.
You know, get the old compost out and save some of the old compost because that'll help to reinfect the fresh stuff coming in and accelerate the process a little bit faster.
Okay. So, well, on the topic of trees and dropping their leaves, the trees, of course, did survive quite a drought this year.
Yeah.
How can we help them out through the winter?
Well, we want to put a little bit of water around their drip line. If you can do that, just lay the hose down. have it drool out like a big dog, and just to have it drool out for about a half an hour.
Gross.
Then move it to another spot where it's dry and have it drool out for a while, because you want to have that soak in and not run off. And so a slow drooling or movement of the water around the drip line of the trees will help benefit them. They'll take up that water. Eventually, it'll make them more resistant to the capricious winter weather that we have.
Okay.
So that's the best thing you can do. Then once you're done, especially if you're talking about recently planted trees within the last year,
mm-hmm.
Once you're done with that, you want to do a 3x3x3 mulch, 3 inches thick, 3 feet from the trunk of the tree at least, and then 3 inches from the trunk, no bark mulch up against the trunk of the tree. And for heaven's sakes, don't use stone. Don't use stone. As
okay.
everybody heard that, don't use stone to mulch around your trees.
Okay. So you want a little bit of distance between the trunk and where it starts.
Right, absolutely.
And then build that up 3 inches, and then it goes out as far as 3 feet.
Right.
Starting at 3 inches. Yeah. Okay.
3x3x3. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good one. I like that one. Houseplants.
Houseplants, we have a tendency to forget about them.
Yeah.
We put them out, and they thrive, and they look good, and they're happy.
Right.
And we think they're part of the annual plants or the perennial plants, but they aren't. We start getting close to 30 degrees, they're mm-hmm. going to start showing it. So watch the weather. Anticipate the weather being nasty at some point in the near future here. Get them out of there for at least 24 hours ahead of time before the cold weather hits. And then put them in isolation somewhere and kind of observe them at room temperature that you're going to be keeping them at, you know, maybe in your basement or an area that you're going to be seeing them on a daily basis, to make sure that nothing hatches and starts crawling out and taking up residency in your home, inside your home, which you don't want. I don't know too many people that want to, you know, take care of insects coming out of
their
houseplants.
Too many.
not too many, no. While we're on the subject of houseplants,
yes.
I don't want to forget amaryllis.
Okay.
You can buy those amaryllis now in some of your big box stores. Some of your garden centers have them now. And you just buy the bulb. It's usually already in a pot.
Mm-hmm.
So all you have to do is bring it home, put it on your table, give it a little bit of water, watch it grow, and bingo, you have in about 6 to 8 weeks nice, big, beautiful flowers showing up there. So
which
it's
will
fun
be
to
nice because
yeah.
it'll probably be quite cold and we'll want some flowers in
yes,
six
yes,
to 8 weeks.
Yes,
so.
And the first initial phases of our winter weather are closing in on us.
Mm-hmm.
We have this beautiful amaryllis that's growing vigorously and making us happy.
Aww.
And we're counting the buds there that are going to open up and bloom for us. And it's just nice to have them. So
I went for a walk yesterday, and I was in downtown Fargo, which uh-huh. has a lot of buildings and a lot of traffic and whatnot. And I was really surprised to hear so many birds, to the point I thought, is somebody playing a recording of a bird? Like, are we just pretending that this is still nature out here? But there were a lot of birds, I thought, for being downtown.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's just because they're all in one spot because there are not as many trees
mm-hmm.
or what have you. But I'm just curious about bird care as we go into the winter.
That's where our birds went, because we have had essentially –
they're down by the pickled parrot. There were
zero
just,
birds this
wow.
summer. I mean, we've had a bird here and a bird there, a woodpecker, a hummingbird
mm-hmm.
a family that visited our little hummingbird feeder.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been about it. In the past, we've been swarmed by birds because Betsy puts out the cracked sunflower seed.
Mm-hmm.
And in the past, that's drawn them like mad, and they've actually fought over it. And then the squirrels are getting all the food. We're entertained by our squirrels, which is no problem at all, but we miss the birds.
Huh.
And we have neither one of us have any idea what's going on. What did we do wrong?
Yeah, you didn't
we pay our taxes, you know.
We keep a
healthy environment. We don't spray a lot of poison around. In fact, we don't spray any poison around, literally, unless it's absolutely necessary to control a particular insect like yellow jackets or wasps.
Hmm.
But we don't know where our birds went. So I'm glad to hear that they're still alive wherever they are. But send them to 2837 Southgate Drive, if you will. Because we miss them.
Okay. But other people trying to attract birds, you said cracked sunflower seeds.
Cracked sunflower seeds is a good one because they love it.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't make a mess. And they're good gleaners. They'll go after the last bit of seed that you have left there, so there's no shell, no husk, no mess to go ahead and clean up.
That
except
is nice.
What the birds leave behind.
How about for starting to take care of some of our perennials right now? I went through my garden last week and started to cut down all my lilies. And then I was like, all right, I'm done with my fall yard care.
Yeah, there's some perennials that you want to leave if you can.
Okay.
For the birds, again, to feed on, because the seed heads are there, like the echinacea, the coneflower, is a very good one. And if you planted sunflowers this year, that's another good one. Bee balm is another one. That should have
for a while?
Yeah, you can leave the heads there.
Okay.
The birds will appreciate it. And then our ornamental grasses, like the big blue stem and the Carl Forrester feather reed grass. They look good swaying back and forth in the wind. And the birds like the seed that's there. And, of course, the rabbits and the squirrels love making a home in those little nice nestly things and come out and pester you in the spring with your fresh plantings. So, yeah.
Okay.
So, anyhow, before we part company here, I wanted to get a tree out, the Katsura.
Okay.
Cool Cat Katsura. K-O-O-L-K-A-T, Katsura. It's a tree that gets to be about 35 to 40 feet tall. You can't buy it today, but you should start seeing them coming up on the market this next year. Okay, it's a patented thing. Dr. Todd West has released it. He got a patent for it, got it approved, and it's a wonderful tree. It's tolerated the temperatures for the last 10 years where it's been grown around the state.
Okay.
Down to 37 degrees below zero.
Right.
Okay, and so, and it doesn't get to be too big, 40 feet tall, has a kind of a nice upright shape to it. We'll probably see it being used in some of our street tree plantings, which the city of Fargo has done a good
job
of.
I've noticed there's a bit more diversity around
cities. Absolutely,
yeah, trees.
And it would be a nice one because it drops its leaves early, and it seems to get rid of the leaves right away, and you can pick them up once, and that's about it. Don't have to keep picking them up as the leaves keep dropping off like it does on my birch. But that diversity is very important, and that's what NDSU has been attempting to do, is introduce some diversity into our street tree settings here. So we don't have, you know, ashes are beautiful trees, but somebody else thinks ashes are beautiful trees too, and it's called the emerald ash borer. It's a very beautiful insect, and it loves our ash trees, and it'll eventually get out here. You know, we can't make it emerald ash borer proof. It's not going to happen. They'll eventually
it's
get here.
It's starting to show up in Minnesota, and so eventually it's going to work its way here.
It'll work its way here.
So it's important, though, now to put those trees in because
Absolutely.
Trees take a long time to mature, of course.
Okay, think of your children, you know, your grandchildren growing up, and they're going to see this beautiful diversity of trees, maples, honey locust, whatever out there, the Katsura maybe, growing along the streets rather than having what would be visually beautiful elms or just the ash trees, if you have the same species, it looks very majestic. But it's ecologically suicidal for those plants to be planted that way because when they're looking their best, that's when they're going to start to have some problems. And you don't want to see them go because you love that nice leafy environment.
And one disease can wipe them all out if you've got all the same. We check in with horticulturist Ron Smith periodically during the growing season. Thanks, Ron.
You're very welcome.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Bill Dean, Realtor Broker with Alliance Real Estate of Bismarck. Buying, selling, investing, and estate planning. Information can be found at BillDeanHomes.com.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 12th. Face masks were widely used during the terrible flu pandemic of 1918. Newspapers carried instructions for making masks from gauze or cheesecloth. The Red Cross made and distributed masks. Health authorities advocated the use of masks. Face masks, when worn properly, stem the spread of germs carried by respiratory droplets from the nose and mouth. As one public notice from 1918 stated, Coughs and sneezes spread diseases as dangerous as poison gas shells, referring to the poison gas used in World War I. In the fall of 1918, in Bismarck, the city health officer ordered waitresses and other people handling food to wear masks. It was said that his order would be strictly enforced. Waitresses of one dining establishment declined, leading authorities to, quote, take steps to see that they comply or are prevented from serving food. On this date in 1918, the Grand Forks County Federal Food Administrator ordered all people serving or preparing food in public places to wear face masks. Many establishments cheerfully complied. Authorities suggested the public eat only at places where servers wore masks. Some establishments paid no attention, as the order was also interpreted as a request. Student Army Training Corps members at the North Dakota Agricultural College in Fargo were required to wear masks. So, too, was everyone connected with the Training Corps post at the University of North Dakota in Grand Forks. In Fargo, masks were a common sight soon after the flu emerged, but as the Forum newspaper reported, gradually the face mask, through familiarity, lost its value, and it first slipped down and became a protection for the Adam's apple, and then was gradually discarded. The story told of some Fargo residents who turned to hot lemonade and raw onions to prevent the flu, but patients and caregivers continued to wear masks. Other measures similar to mask mandates can be found in North Dakota history. In the summer of 1953, Grand Forks health authorities required children, 14 and younger, to wear caps to curb a scalp ringworm epidemic. Hundreds of children were affected by the fungal infection. Children without ringworm also had to wear numbered aluminum discs, like dog tags, for admission to movie theaters, churches, swimming pools, and buses. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
I'm Capri Cafaro, host of Eat Your Heartland Out. We explore the cultural significance of baking in the American Midwest. Cookbook author Shauna Seaver shares the joy of baking through her cookbook, Midwest Made. Val Lux, founder of the Great Midwestern Pie Bake-Off, discusses why pie captures the Midwestern spirit. And journalist Selena Zito introduces us to the cherished tradition of the wedding cookie table. A slice of Americana on Eat Your Heartland Out.
Eat Your Heartland Out, coming up tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we parents like to think we're doing all of the teaching, but our kids have a lot of teaching for us. We visit with Tom Rademacher, the author of the new book, Raising Ollie, about what his non-binary kid taught him about parenting. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.